rooms, and Ronnie and his cousins could not be found. I did not want to let this spoil things. I was not offended that our navigator crawled into the back and studied the Reddick's rulebook, as if reading would have us win.
"You'll get carsick," my husband said.
"No, I won't," said Buck Hoover. And in this dull way, the Reddick's trial began, as tame and ordinary as a Sunday drive. I did not know what Titch had been up to. We rose from our lovely, fertile valley, and I could not know that I would soon become a wrong'un. Ahead of us was the climb from the flat country up Pretty Sally, a dormant bald volcano, a radiator boiler of a road, with an accident black spot due to a sharp turn near its crest. I was thrilled to feel the go in our engine. There were no freeways, just the Hume Highway with yellow gravel verges, broken fan belts, semi-trailer skid marks. A two-lane track with bridges too narrow for two vehicles to pass. The highway led us through streets of prosperous small towns, Euroa, Violet Town, Benalla, Glenrowan, Wangaratta. We arrived in Yass, in New South Wales, the road chock-full of all-night truckies' cafes and spare parts garages and panel shops.
"See that?" Buck Hoover said at last.
He indicated a signpost. We did not respond.
63 miles to Young. That's Lamming Flat."
"Is that a fact?" I never knew about the so-called riots at Lamming Flat. Why would I? They had occurred a century before, apparently. There had been thousands of Chinese miners just down the road at Lamming Flat.
"Poor buggers," he called them with emotion in his voice.
The nasty white miners had knocked apart the Chinese tents and stolen everything inside. There was gunfire and police saber charges, and one man was left dead. I thought, oh no. I squeezed my husband's hand, but still he stopped the car.
"Get out," Titch told our navigator. "Yes, you. There's something I want you to do for me." "Of course." "Just walk around a bit. Tell me what you see."
I thought, he's going to drive off. He's going to leave Buck Hoover and Yass.
"No, don't," I said.
Titch was waiting behind the wheel. "Please?" I asked. Meanwhile, Buck Hoover was on the footpath, staring in the window of the baker's. Then he was in the middle of the double lines, with the traffic whizzing past each side.
"Pretty town," he said when he came back. "So?"
Titch asked.
"What did you see?"
"Nice gold rush buildings," he began. "All the money in the courthouse and the pubs.
Any Chinamen?"
"Not a one."
And he was grinning, his teeth very white in his tanned face.
"Any blood?"
"Not a drop, I'm pleased to say."
"You're the navigator," Titch said. "You tell us what is happening now. I could not give a fuck about what happened 100 years ago.
I was embarrassed. I smiled at our poor navigator so he knew I liked him. Titch pulled back into the traffic.
"I was a chauffeur for a Chinese herbalist," he said. "My father sold him a Model A. Then I lived with the family in Little Bourke Street. Mr. Goon, his name was."
I thought, here it is. One more torture he never told me.
"He was a clever man, the herbalist," my husband said. "He had a little velvet cushion, and he would lay the patient's hand on it and touch it very gently. The goons wanted me to go back to China with him. If my dad had not needed me, I would have gone. So when you tell me about all that business back there, you haven't got a bloody clue what I think. I've never seen children treated so kindly in all my life."
And then I loved him, more than I ever knew I loved him. He had grown up with no mother, been raised by a cruel father. He was a wonder, wresting love from dung. And now he was in the Reddick's trial,
It was impossible. The road markings changed from white to yellow, and we were in another world. We travelled together towards the start, along the rain-slicked narrow highway, beneath clouds like greasy wool, through wide-set sodden winter farms, the unrelenting green of paddocks, the distant mountains of the great dividing range. At Mittagong, 70 miles from Sydney, I saw sunstruck sandstone, gum trees with skin like elephants. I was in driver heaven. It was exactly at this point we first heard an engine roar. Not a truck, but something big. It sounded like a tractor doing 100 miles an hour. It was then we saw him pass, the bastard, the devil, like a wasp from a mud nest. Dan Bobbs, the enemy of my husband's happiness. Behind him came a police car, blue light flashing. Bastard. Bastard. I would have killed him if I could.
Chapter 2. I had written away for my own copy of the Red X rulebook and had also purchased an expensive Curta calculator to prepare for my role. The Bobbsies teased me about the book because they thought the rules so obvious, and as for the Curta calculator, they had never heard of such a thing. The Curta was beautiful in the way of a Zeiss lens, and was a thing I would not normally have had any excuse to buy. Fortunately, the Red X was a contest where average speeds were everything. As the officials kept saying, it was not a race, but a grueling test of machinery in the outback conditions. That is, we must prove our car reliable. If we arrived a minute early, we lost points. Ditto if we came in late. The purpose of the Curta was to constantly recalculate the speed required to arrive on time. I entered the prescribed average speed, official mileage, odometer reading, corrected speed in miles per minute. No one joked about it in the end. The rulebook decreed that reliability was the only issue. There could be no major rebuilds of engine, transmission, chassis or suspension. Components were sprayed with a special paint visible under a mercury vapour lamp. There were scrutineers waiting for us everywhere, as annoying as policemen in their way. As for the police themselves, they hated us. They knew what the rulebook would not admit, that the drivers were all maniacs, gathered to race, to burn each other off, to do the ton, to get ahead, to make up time, to sometimes create breathing space for adjustments and repairs, but always, no matter what they said in interviews, to make the other fella eat my dust. We entered Sydney at 30 miles per hour.
Chapter 3. Neither Titch nor I had ever been to Sydney. Don't laugh. We'd never seen the harbour, the bridge, a Bondi tram, a ferry. Never even bought a pound of prawns. As my husband told the street photographer, we were business maggots from Bacchus Marsh. We ate oysters Kilpatrick for the first time. We almost forgot what we had come for. It was a shock, in late afternoon, to stroll into the Sydney showground and see what we were up against. 267 hardened competitors, armoured with massive bull bars, done up in war paint, arranged on the dirt speedway ring inside the parade ground. Lex Davison, Jack Brabham, all the cracks had gathered to the fray. The press were there, camera flashes erupting in dense clusters like a battlefield. A cat could look at a king. We dropped in on Jack Davies' crew. He said, "Hi-ho, everybody," like he does on radio. Two cars over was a swarm of flashbulbs dying for the fame. It was Dan Bobbs still in the race, with his false teeth and his false smile, and his arm around two pretty girls, the Women's Weekly crew. "Gotta hand it to him," his son said. "He doesn't give up." Give up, throw up. In the rubbish bin, I found the morning's newspapers. Mad dash for starting line. Mr. Bobbs had hit a stone and damaged the back plate on his differential, which lost its oil. In Benalla, he filled the diff with heavy oil and made a dash for Mittagong, where the new differential was fitted. He made up lost time thanks to Sergeant Cody and Constable Withers of the Highway Patrol, who had escorted the former aviator to the showgrounds, where he had admirers waiting to assist. Dan Bobbs, I read, was well known to the motoring fraternity. I don't think this was true. He was also a wily prankster, a joker, a character, suspected of playing pranks with Jellignite in previous car trials, a habit which had him named Dangerous Dan. The reporter had learned of the existence of a second driver, Mr. Sullivan, my little Englishman, according to Dan Bobbs, and also revealed the former aviator had a daughter-in-law in Holden No. 92.
"Women can wear overalls all they like," Bobbs said, "but they can't teach their father-in-law to suck eggs."
He reportedly had little patience for women cluttering up the contest.
"Don't worry about it," my husband said. "Forget it."
As usual, he did not understand his father would destroy us any way he could. Bakuba found a boarding house, 10 minutes from the starting line. The landlord had had a stroke and would not give up his best chair by the wireless. As we could not hear the ABC news, the landlady undertook to provide the papers in the morning for a shilling each. Likewise, we were refused the use of her telephone, and I was forced back into the showground, where the red phone boxes were lined up by the toilets, offering a full view of the only person I did not wish to see. Dan, surrounded by his subjects, removed his hat and bowed to me. There were a mob of drivers crowded around the telephone boxes, rattling loose change in their pockets, as if their private parts were made of silver. These same jokers thought it amusing I was wearing overalls. I did not care. I waited. It was only when I got to the phone I saw that my father-in-law was in the next-door box, making a show of saluting me. I turned my back and heard Ronnie had gone down the shops to buy lemonade, and Beverly was still at the hairdresser. Dan was now kneeling, tying up his boots, not caring about who might be waiting to call their wife. I ignored him in favour of Edith, who needed help with the recipe for golden syrup dumplings. We were just mixing in the butter when there was an enormous bang. I did not know what world I was in. Dan's phone box jumped in the air. It fell over on its side. I saw the receiver lying on the grass. My phone was dead. Poor Edith, I thought. Poor little girl. I ran into a shower of flashbulbs blinding me. I was in tears when I got back to Titch. I told him his father tried to kill me. I was told to relax. Blowing up toilets was Dad's favourite trick. Did he kill me? No, he didn't. If he had wanted to, he would have. I lay awake for hours and hours, thinking my husband should stick up for me. I woke to find my photograph on the front page. An ugly woman in overalls, her mouth like a torn rag. Red X starts with a bang. I was Irene Bobbs, co-driver of Holden No. 92. I was, by sheer coincidence, the daughter-in-law of Dangerous Dan Bobbs. At the time of yesterday's explosion, Mr. Dan Bobbs had been in serious conversation with Sergeant Dick Worthington of the New South Wales Police. The two men were some considerable distance from the telephone booths involved. The reporters had already used up all the male contestants. They went off to Granny Conway, car number 28, who was very pleased to give her opinion of me. I should quit pranking. I should wear a skirt. I should drive carefully, and then I wouldn't need to copy all the men who raced ahead to make repairs before the checkpoint. The journos found me working on our vehicle. Would I comment? No, I wouldn't. My father-in-law had a low opinion of women drivers. What did I think of that? Seeing how he tried to blow me up, I said, he must be a bit worried. Did I plan to beat him? They wished to know. I said I would destroy him. If I'd been a footballer, that would have been okay. But now I got us named the Feuding Bobs. Titch, it seemed, heard none of this. He wanted to buy me a pretty dress for the photographers, but we had to attend a road safety lecture by the Road Safety Council and the police traffic branch. We checked air, tyres, water, oil, and tightened everything that might shake loose. I put on some lippy for the photographers who never came. The front seat must be adjusted to the driver's legs, so the navigator must conform, and Bakuba's knees were therefore bent and pushed against the dashboard, where they would be locked in place for 18 days. He was hard at work with a tricky gadget, calculating how to maintain the 22 miles per hour average required. We departed at ordered intervals of 1 minute, after which we must suffer the hysteria of the New South Wales police. Being forced by law to crawl, we were overtaken by Sunday drivers and hoons and lowered Holdens with three-quarter grind camshafts. Their younger brothers manipulated the crossing lights to make us stop and sign their autograph books. Bakuba began updating instructions based on his Kurta calculator. We saw the sea at Newcastle, and then were winding through the bush, overtaking semi-trailers. Then the country changed, and slow brown rivers looped and snaked across the gaudy green. There was heavy rain between Taree and Coffs Harbour, then pineapples and bananas, like in a foreign country with bright green hills, the highway as muddy as a pig paddock. The locals turned peevish and changed the road signs, but credit where credit was due, the Kurta was a beauty. Titch drove, I drove. The navigator was calm and level. I checked us into Brisbane, 600 miles of Sunday driving. Titch had fortunately missed my comments to the Sydney press. That night I dreamed I had a baby, which the court ruled must be taken from me. They would not say my crime.
Chapter 4. This was the tropics and all that suggests. For hundreds of sweaty miles I had breathed Mrs. Bobsey's neck, her familiar sister skin. It was a cruel road of boulders, dry creeks, tidal creeks, ruts, deep holes, scrubby floodplain, a few hills, although the toughest obstacle was sorting out the confusion caused by two conflicting official maps. In this schmuzzle, 50 cars were unfairly penalised, and their crews lost 12 hours of rest time while they appealed injustice and ineptitude. My two drivers, on the other hand, were free to find a boarding house and telephone their kids. The navigator gained great kudos. Now it was time to sleep chastely beneath the cooling car. No one knew my dreams. With morning came the Bobsey husband, smooth-cheeked, fragrant with old spice and baby powder, his black hair flat across his perfect head. Did I sleep well? Like a madman, I did not say. "Good man," he said. "Today the road would be a nightmare. He had no need of average speeds." "What about secret checkpoints?" "F the secret checkpoints," he cried, pulling on his yellow chamois gloves. "Machinery would get murdered now," he said. The official map described the road as undulating, which meant it was a series of ramps which had the vehicle airborne half the time. It undulated its way through dreary subtropical brigalow, brownish grass, sleepy creeks whose murderous alter egos had previously ripped the banks apart and left jagged descents and rocky beds I would never have dared to drive across. I had the utmost confidence in Titch's ability, even though his eyes were only inches above the steering wheel. The map said water crossings and sudden drops, and I kept my head on my shoulders as we slid and drifted with the wheel sliding through the driver's perfect yellow gloves. On a straight stretch of 2.5 miles, we were overtaken by Frank Kleinig in a Peugeot 203. Then the Humber Super Snipe Works team, who were nice enough to wave. Mrs. Bobsey forced a stop. She was concerned about a blowout, due to increased tyre pressure in the heat. They released 40 pounds. Husband, 2 tyres, wife, the rest. We were overtaken by Ken Tubman's team. Now Mrs. Bobsey was at the wheel. She had a lovely bump on her nose. She reported the old bugger was on our tail. Let him go. But hers was not a nose to yield. It's not a race, her husband said. We were in Tubman's dust, and Dan, the old grey shark, was charging at our rear. The road was narrow, bumpy, decorated with broken windscreen glass. It had spongy edges that I feared would roll us over. Titch was clutching the front seat with an eye peeled for kangaroos. Mrs. Bobsey's eyes were watery with dust or domestic issues. Titch said, "Let him pass, let him pass." "Bend into deep drain," I said. She got it perfectly, sliding gracefully to the side so the grey Plymouth edged slowly by. Her high collar travelled all the way below her buttons. Who would have guessed it would feel just like a dance, even with the dust and danger and her husband breathing in my ear? "Rough road, 0.9 miles, I said. I thought, this is it. This is my life at last. Then came a mighty percussion, and I recognised the brutal slap of Jellignite. My innards came into my mouth, and the whole rear end was smacked sideways across the road. "Controlled explosion," Titch said. "Take a joke." "Grid in 2 clicks. Now a corrugated road in the Plymouth's dust. I waited for the second explosion as we shook and rattled at 60 miles an hour, while Mrs. Bobsey shouted F and C and B and S like a woman giving birth. My Lord, she stirred me up. I would not have missed it for the world.
Chapter 5. By now, I thought, my reported comments to the Sydney journalists must be wrapped around fish and chips. If so, that was not enough to save me from my punishment. My husband had read the Sydney Press in Brisbane. He had not said a word. He had stewed in private for 400 miles. Not until we were dealing with overheated tyres did he judge it time to speak. He was disappointed, he said. It was not so much what I had said about his father, it was the damage I had done to the value of our name. This was why we were in the Red X, apparently. I had thought it was so he would have something to look forward to, but I must have been wrong. We were in the Red X to merchandise our famous brand. He stank of Dunstan. He said there was a knack in talking to reporters. It was one thing to criticise his father, but perhaps I could learn from Dan and how he used the newspapers. There was a definite art to it. Art, fart. He pulled the rug from under me and never knew what he'd done. We stopped at Tallulah, some place spelt like that approximately, just a few miles inland from a lovely beach I never saw. There was an abandoned petrol station and a working telephone box. It was in this place I discovered Ronnie had the measles. Beverly was waiting for the doctor's call, so please get off the phone. I asked my husband what we should do now. He said we had to make up time. They reckon Gladstone is the gateway to the wonders of the Great Barrier Reef. I remember the smokestacks and my despair on learning that the doctor had still not arrived in Bacchus Marsh. We were now 1,200 miles away from Ronnie. It was the day I drove the so-called horror stretch, well named for every minute of what lay ahead. The unexpected comfort came from Buckhuber. I was so grateful for his reassuring hand as we dropped down into a creek and slammed the armour-plated diff against the rocks. "Nicely played," he said. Then Titch was driving, pushing the speed. But he drifted wide around a bend and nearly hit Dan's Plymouth, on its roof in the middle of the sugar cane. "Don't stop," I thought. We don't have that luxury. How bloody sad to feel him break. He was still his father's dog.
Chapter 6. The first Aboriginals I ever saw were rocking Dan's Plymouth back and forth. As I crossed the road, the car rolled upright and stood on its wheels again, swaying, steaming, in a nest of sugar cane. The red-headed co-driver was already back behind the wheel. While Dan checked all the vehicle's windows, his new friends pressed around him eagerly. What conversation took place between them was difficult to know, although the voices of the rescuers became progressively higher in their pitch. There was also a quieter fellow, perhaps 60, not tall like his boyish comrades, but broad-shouldered and barrel-chested, with a deep, furrowed brow, hooded, bloodshot eyes, grey stubble and a mischievous disposition. The younger men were in a flock, in persistent negotiation with a moving but resistant centre. This was Dan, who had, he said, no bucksheesh. The older man showed no interest in this altercation. All his attention was on me. I held out my hand. He took it. Where you been grow up? Near Melbourne, far away. Bloody Yarra River, he said, not inclined to release his hold. Then, suddenly, he tugged my fair hair. At the time, I thought this strange. I think it even stranger now. Proper white fella, he said. I'm Willie. Willie Buckhuber. Buckhuber, no way, he said. My scalp was stinging, but he was smiling. I had my driver's license, and I showed him. Proper white fella, he smiled. It would be days before I realized he knew more than I did. In any case, I would never have allowed the possibility that he was being sarcastic. I thought, dear God, perhaps his grandparents had been killed by white men. Gulbulba? I asked, because this was Gulbulba country on my mental map. Bakhuba, the man said. Perhaps I mispronounced Gulbulba. Goodbye, I said. The Plymouth's engine roared. The air was full of violent dust. My shins were stung by a shower of gravel. The young men threw a stone or two at the fleeing Plymouth, and then turned on Titch, whose hand was already in his pocket. The old man had another go at my hair, but I was ready for him, and he laughed when I clamped his wrist. Back in the car, I arranged my clipboard and my map. I said nothing about the tragic history of these men Titch was calling bungs. 10.2 miles... Left right bend on creek. It was hard going. It took all of 18 minutes before we reached the place where I glanced upstream and saw, to the west, amongst the tangled, flood-washed tree trunks, another Red X car, a Holden, decked out in violent racing livery with decals and a number it is wisest I not mention. The car was pitched nosed down, almost vertical, pointing into the dribbling creek. Rolled vehicles would soon be a common sight, but this second one seemed impossible. Its back wheels were in the air, leaving its springs as naked as a corpse's private parts. Titch quietly braked and killed the engine. He indicated we were to leave both the car and Mrs. Bobsey. We called, "Cooey!" Otherwise the creek was quiet with no bird call, except a mournful currawong crying, as usual, like a lost child. We clambered over the snaggy tree trunk flotsam and saw, through the open driver's window, strip maps scattered front and rear, and the key in the ignition. There was a strong smell of mashed bananas. The crashed vehicle seemed so perilously arranged, I would not have gone anywhere near the radiator, but Titch, having placed himself in a position where he might have been crushed to death, announced the radiator was almost cool. There was something oddly furtive about him now, and he climbed up a mouldy tree trunk to the flood-time bank and stood, like a yellow-gloved wood spirit, with his left hand supporting his right elbow and his right hand across his bright red mouth. "Tell her to bring the car down here," he said at last. "How?" "Along the track we walked on." "She can't drive there." "Just tell her, Willie." It was the first time he called me by my Christian name.
Chapter 7. The car was stopped. My husband vanished. Barkuba was at my open door, apologising for waking me. There had been an accident. Would I kindly drive our vehicle along the track beside the creek? I did so, imagining we were on a mission of mercy. But then Titch announced we were to remove a set of rear leaf springs. I asked would he make his wife a grave robber. He winked, and I saw he planned to somehow cheat. Barkuba and I worked on the teetering carcass exactly as we had done the drill in Bacchus Marsh. There was a bad smell of rotting leaves around the scene, and it was still clinging to our clothes later as we hid the looted springs and clips beneath our own rear seat. No one told me that we would be able to reuse these springs without penalty. My husband kept that secret from me. The Riddick scrutineers had used radioactive paint on the original components. So if we used these stolen springs, the Geiger counters would not know. Witnessing this deceit, I thought of Mrs. Marcus. We still had 6 hours' drive to Townsville, and when we had stowed the springs, it was come on, hurry, come on, pedal to the metal. I said I must attend to a call of nature. He told me to be real. I thought, he has wasted time to help his father. Now he can waste some time on me. I deliberately took along my front-page interview to wipe my bottom. If he noticed, he did not comment. Being a man, the navigator was surely thinking like they do, that I must remove my overalls and be nude as Eve, just up the track. So I went a long way up the creek, amongst a nest of broken sticks and leaves and timber smashed up by the floods. I carried our little garden trowel until I came upon a huge tree ripped out by its roots, so it left a crater 6 feet deep. That saved a lot of digging. I teetered over the crater, naked as the day, clinging to a mud-crusted tree root. My call of nature was just a whisper. On the crater walls, only a foot from the surface, I saw the roots had grown around dead bones. The first crumbled in my hands, and I saw there were so many others. A graveyard. Sickening. That is, these were not animals. There were so many, they must be blacks. I extracted a human jawbone. I retreated. I rushed back into my overalls. I was an interfering woman. I climbed down into the excavation, where I was able to lift a human skull from the broken soil. It was just a tiny thing, as fragile and powdery as an emu egg. I was a mother. I knew what it was to hold a tender child, and I knew this must be a little boy, and all these bones around him must be his family. He was quite clean and very light, and it seemed he might return to dust if I was clumsy. So I tucked the digging tool in my back pocket and held him in both hands, then carried him, as carefully as if he were a bowl of water, back through the dull shrubs and grasses. When I arrived at our car, I showed them what I had.
"It's okay," Titch said. "I'll drive."
He had nothing more to add. The navigator opened the back door for me, but then he stood in front of me, peering down at my little fellow, so long dead. Barkuba had a pencil stuck behind his ear, as always, and now he removed it, and I moved the little head away from him. "But no," he said. He wished only to point out the round hole, right where the little ear had once listened to the water of the creek. God knows why I cried about something so long ago. My husband did his best to understand, but this was not our fault. We never knew this pickaninny. I didn't drive for the next 6 hours, but I felt the angry corrugations on the road as big as railway sleepers. I smelt the leaves from the riverbank like the abattoirs and tanneries from my childhood. Poor little boy. I held him like a mother does, with my palm around the back of his head. Then the road was deep between the shivering sugar cane, 12 feet tall, it seemed. We were insects speeding through the secret grass. Sometimes we had horizon, sometimes not. Then we idled in the morning dark as farmers set the cane on fire. Ash blew through our open windows. Burdekin snow, they called the cinders. I held his little smudgy head and listened to the cane fire in full roar. I nursed him as we passed through endless cane fields. The tropical towns had smokestacks and lumpy mills and grey worn-out houses built on poles. There was rambling bougainvillea so big and old it was pulling down its trellises. Finally, at dusk, we checked into the Townsville showgrounds. In the giant fig trees above our heads, hordes of lorikeets squabbled over who would sleep with whom and where. It was a foreign land to me. When my husband was informed I intended to take the skull to the police station, he ordered Buck Huber to accompany me. I would have appreciated it if he could come along himself. No, he had to see a man about a dog. Careful he doesn't bite your bum, I did not say. The showgrounds were in Townsville's west end, and the police were at least 2 miles away. So the locals had plenty of time to gawp at me. There was a woman wearing overalls. Well, blow me down. The police station was as big as a factory, and here we found a sergeant grappling with a black man, the worse for wear, and we had to wait until he'd been escorted to his sleeping quarters before we could state our business. I will not say the sergeant laughed or smirked, but he was certainly discomforted and had great difficulty in knowing how he could assist the Red X crew. So what was I meant to tell him? Was it really such a puzzle? A crime had been done by someone. Buck Huber pointed out the bullet hole. "Your boyfriend has forensic knowledge?" the policeman asked me. Then to Buck Huber, "Looks like you might have a personal interest in the Dusky Races, mate." "Oh, really? Just looking at you, mate. It's obvious." "What do you see?" "It might not be obvious where you come from, mate. Up here, we have what you might call an educated eye." I asked him what this had to do with Dusky Races. "You're from the South, missus. Your boyfriend is a white man in the South." I thought, we'll have a good laugh about this tonight. "Then good on you. Good luck to you both. As for this matter..." He pushed the little head towards me. "You should consider it a souvenir. May even be worth a bob or two down there. What's so funny, Jimmy?" And he stared at Buck Huber until he looked away. "Now," he turned to me, "here's what we'll do about your lost and found." From deep in a drawer, he produced a large receipt book with many sheets of carbon paper. He fetched a steel-nibbed pen of the type you see in post offices, and on the form he wrote, "Abbo Infant Skull, found near Funnel Creek, Finch Haddon." I did not question how he knew the child had been Aboriginal, or how he guessed the place names, and I had no choice but to accept the piece of paper together with the skull. He had no room to store it, so he claimed. I carried the small cardboard box into the tropical night, and I suppose we were both thinking the cop must be Troppo. I was embarrassed, so I held my tongue. The air was rank with flying foxes, and I saw them blanket the sky above the showgrounds like bombers on a raid. The Red X crews had gathered at the West End Hotel, where small bats were feasting on the insects around the lights. The pub was like a glowing wedding cake, built in the ornate style of years gone by. The public bar was on the ground floor, but the crews were all upstairs, crowded on the wide veranda, leaning over the floral cast-iron balustrades. My husband was in a jolly mood, calling down to us to join him. I felt foolish with my cardboard box and hid it beneath the stairs. Then the only obstacle was a green frog, as big as a dinner plate, sitting bug-eyed on the landing. I politely stepped around him. Upstairs I found a barmaid who demanded I name my poison, and I said I'd have a beer and asked Buck Hooper what he'd have.
"You got your certificate?" she asked him.
"We're not from here," he said.
I said I had no certificate either.
"You don't need one, love, but he knows what I mean."
Of course I ignored her nonsense. I ordered a beer for me and a lemonade for my navigator.
"Well, he can certainly have that," she said.
And whatever tickets she had previously required, she did not want them now. She must have seen how warmly we were accepted by the creme de la creme, famous drivers with their war stories. For example, a hillman somersaulting 3 times before sliding to a halt on loose gravel. A vanguard flying from a jump-up and landing with such a thump its rear window fell out. We were an elite crew who had not lost a single point. In less than a minute, I would be inches from Lex Davison and Jack Brabham, who would soon become our mates. And there he was, in the midst of all his towering heroes, the very complicated bloke I married. Handsome Titch Bobs was once again illuminated by inner light, a leader in the 1954 Red X trial, pushing his finger into Jack Davies' chest. He got the usual laugh for being a business maggot from Bacchus Marsh. He was understood, celebrated, high above the Townsville showgrounds, and I saw no reason to dwell on his deceit in the matter of the looted springs.
Part 3. Across the Top End, 1,600 miles. Chapter 1. The Bobbses had pre-booked a room for themselves in the hotel. I was allocated a cot in an abandoned wartime barracks where I cleaned the frog droppings from the floor, squeezed lemon juice on ears and toes, pulled the sheet over my head and stretched my legs out straight at last. By the time the drunken crews returned, my brain was far away, filled with endless looping roads. My ears were itching from mosquito bites. In my dream, I had become a black man in a court. I suppose this was set off by the idiot in the police station, driven hysterical by his own white purity. In my dream, I was accused of being a spy. I was brought before a judge, who was a connoisseur of race. The ugly term stays with me. He thought I possessed knowledge of all routes, paths, roads, ancient and modern tracks, like veins and arteries in the viscera of prawns. The curtain fell apart. I scrambled on the courthouse floor, searching for the screws. Impossible. Too small to hold. There was a farting competition in the barracks. Meanwhile, in my dreams, I had hundreds of maps, but I was no longer sure which was the official route. Beverly was somehow there. She made a dirty joke about route, R-O-U-T-E, and route, R-O-O-T, and rubber. She gave me an eraser, and I must rub out all these vacuum oil and shell and esso roots, or I would be disgraced. Mrs. Bobbsey was present, whispering that she would kill to win. She showed me a peculiar screwdriver, in confidence. The crumbling eraser destroyed fierce lines of bluish-black crushed ants. I called the turns in a foreign language. Ahe flupwa. I thought, I must remember this. My face in the shaving mirror, white as it ever was. It was the men's opinion at the self-serve breakfast in the barracks that Mrs. Bobbsey was up herself. She had drunk too much. She had boasted she was going to win. I fled the barracks for our car, where I napped amongst the backseat jumble until Titch arrived with bloodshot eyes and Alka-Seltzer. I accompanied Mrs. Bobsey to the newsagent, where we found ourselves amongst the favourites. There was a telegram for Mrs. Bobsey, and one for me. "Please report any giant wombats. Bev." That is, she was threatening to report my night vision problems to her sister. I should have revealed them anyway, but you could ask any semi-driver, or simply examine the skid marks on those long straight stretches of highway where weary brains had projected hypnagogic nonsense on the road ahead. I was a good navigator, it was proven. Sometimes at night I saw things that were not there. As we came back to the showgrounds, the cars were leaving at one-minute intervals, and the motorcycle cops were revving their Triumph 500s. Our departure slot was in 20 minutes' time. "Just watch me go," said Mrs. Bobsey, beautiful, bloodshot, with tangled hair.
Chapter 2. As we cut across the continent from east to west, the little boy was safe between us and his cardboard box. Barkuba navigated me across dry, beachy land, hills and flats, arid plains of reddish kangaroo grass. There were more trees than I'd expected. God knows what murder was buried there, curled up in their roots. Two level crossings. At 29.5, a culvert and a long, single track. Then a talcum powder dust bowl, then a switch of soil. We cut between grey banks. We banged over baked clay, into long ruts spiked with rocks and roots. It was said the real Australia is beautiful, but not by me. My father-in-law was defeated, done, dusted. He had already lost 100 points, but now he was filling up my rear-view mirrors. There was no room to let him pass, not even if I wanted to. The edges of the track were piled high with sand. He charged me. I braked. He sat on his horn. My husband ordered me to take it easy, keep my panties on. "Don't speak like that," I said. Buckhuber touched my knee. "Bear left," he said. I did so. There was a worrying suggestion from the exhaust valve, although how could I hear anything above this clatter? Titch instructed me to let his father pass. "He's just having fun." "Ha, bloody ha," I thought. "Pull over for him, let him pass." "No." "It's not a race, missus." The road now widened and the Plymouth pulled around us, and I saw the Cockney sidekick was at the wheel. The big boss was rolling down his window to the dust. I could see his mouth opening, and he was signalling for me to wind down my window. "He wants to tell us something." Barkeeper nudged. "Dip over culvert," he said. "You're driving like a girl," called Dangerous Dan as we both hit the culvert, and I swung the wheel so close you could not fit a razor blade between the vehicles. "I'll murder him," I said. "Next stop, I will kill him." "Puss," my husband pleaded for his father. I thought, not that, not now. I have fought for you for years and years. "You bloody well support me," I said. "I'm your wife." He patted my shoulder and I thought, you have no clue what I'm feeling. Barkuba called, "Grid!" The map showed a road, but nothing was so definite in real life. It was a cleared strip through scrub, punctuated by washaways, long stretches of sand, sudden jump-ups, blind crests, cattle grids and kamikaze cattle. We had Dunlop on off-road tyres, thank Titch for that. Thank Titch for Mrs. Marcus, too. He expected everything to be overlooked. We could not escape potholes, dead kangaroos and dust. Bulldust, they call it. We passed more broken cars than I could number. If dust was fattening, I would have weighed a ton. There was petrol in 80 miles, at Charters Towers.
The town turned out to be as lost and broken as those abandoned cars. The main street was occupied by rusty old emporiums, piles of mullock overgrown with weeds and rubber vines, weary, unpainted houses set on stilts. The petrol station was an old mill burned down in tragedy, with just a lonely petrol pump remaining. As we pulled in, I saw the old Buzzard's Plymouth stopped across the narrow street. There were the usual rubbernecks standing on the footpath, but I had the tire lever in my hand. I planned to serve him right. I knocked on his filthy passenger window, just to have him pay attention to his punishment. There was the little Englishman. My father-in-law was behind the wheel. At that moment, I did not know about his heart attack. How could I? When I whacked the windscreen, I thought he was alive. That should wake him up, I thought. I was set upon by rubberneckers. Some oaf got his hands upon my shoulders. I squirmed away, but it was a cattle town with drover's men and station agents, and they had no trouble removing a tire lever from a woman's hand. Finally, it sunk in. He was dead. I thought I did it to him. The windscreen glass was in 1,000 little bits, and when they laid him down, I heard the sound of his threadbare skull against the footpath. His false teeth were nowhere to be found. There was a great, clumsy lump of policemen, in shorts and long white socks, assisted by the co-driver. Must be a wig, I thought of the little Englishman, of all the things to think at such a time. I saw my husband was laying his head on his father's chest. The old man's eyes were wide and staring, his mouth open. Death had not improved his looks. All my married life, I had worked to protect Titch from his father's malice, and his father had done everything he could to keep his sonny in a cage. It had been the purpose of my life to make sure my husband knew the comfort of being loved. Now it seemed all this had been for nothing. He threw himself on the dead body, in public. There was nowhere left to hide his relentless, secret love. I did not grudge him his grief, but I felt none of it. I was a driver in a race that I had sacrificed my inheritance to enter. When I crossed the road to our car, I knew we could spare an hour for mourning. But then I discovered our car would not restart. The battery was dead, the regulator not functioning. I told the little Englishman to find an undertaker. He had blue, blue eyes, but they would not look at me. A crowd had gathered. God knows where they had come from. I asked Buck Huber to find the undertaker, and he returned to escort me into a dusty store with hats and boots and a wrought-iron balcony around the upstairs floor, where she in charge of haberdashery was also the funeral director. I had buried my parents within a month of each other. I knew what must be done for Dan. I chose the coffin and the handles. I wrote a check for embalming. And then we had another 3/4 of an hour to spare. Buck Huber went off to arrange a jump start for the car. The haberdasher was cursed with a very white skin and was the most sunburned undertaker you could imagine. I wrote her a check to ship the coffin to Mrs. Donaldson and Morty Alec. Due to embalming, there was no ice surcharge. I paid cash for a telegram to Melbourne, and I admit I did not wish to be the one to break the news on the phone. That was wrong. I knew it. I was not in my right mind. It was the middle of winter, but hot in Charters Towers, where, in the shadow of a mullock heap, I found my distraught husband in his nice yellow sweater and his driving gloves, lost to all the world. I held him, but he did not want holding. I told him everything I'd arranged, and that Dan would soon be with Mrs. Donaldson. "What sort of person do you think I am?" he asked. I said I loved him. I would give my life for him and his ambitions. Had done so since day one. "I can't just drive away and leave my father." A better woman would have granted this, a saner woman possibly, but I could not permit Dan Bobbs to defeat us as he wished. "You can't give up," I said.
"This is my duty."
I said his duty was for himself and the family he would sacrifice everything so he could win. people were listening, I suppose, but why should I care who heard me in Charters Towers? I asked my husband what sort of person did he think I was. I'd left our babes, for what? I'd spent our inheritance, for what? Not so I could give up halfway through.
All right, he said. Then go.
His eyes were foreign, and I thought of my sister, who I never understood before. You could be married to a man and not know who he was.
Piss off, then,
he said for the first and last time in his life. Yes, I will.
The regulator is up shit creek,
he said, as if that were an apology. I said I would look after that, and not to worry.